aggressively flirting with her the whole flight. And, you know, he couldn't get them to really leave her alone. And, you know, and she was very obviously put off by the, you know, heavy duty, you know, very forward advances being made by the two men. But she kept doing her job. And they get close to the end of the flight, and one of the guys, as they were about to land, and the guy in the back of the plane, you know, got so aggressive as he handed her an envelope that had the key to his apartment, you know, and said to her, you know, I'll see you tonight. So Paul Harvey said, so she took them, and she walked back to the front of the plane to the other guy who was a flirt, and handed him the envelope and said, "Ah, we'll see you tonight." You know, I think there were a couple of very disappointed guys. Yeah, very excited and very frustrated, you know. But it, when we look at this passage, the major part of the passage, it just, you know, I think we've all been through times when you're doing something, having some event, and you get very disappointed when someone you're just absolutely certain is going to be there, and they don't show up. Why did she look at him? Who didn't show up? You know, and that happens every once in a while, you know, and people get all upset. You know, that sort of sets the stage for what's going to happen in chapter 4. At the end, when we finished last week, Samuel had just received this vision from God and began to talk to him and tell him he was going to do something shocking, and all of that was, you know, going to take place. But you have this sort of transition in verse 19 of chapter 3. You know, I'll pick up here. It says, as Samuel grew up, the Lord was with him. So I want you to understand that there's this transition in verse 19 to the end of the chapter, as Samuel grew up. You're probably talking 15 years in these verses. You know, by the time we get to the end of the chapter, Samuel is probably 25 years old. It could be 20 years here. It could be a long time that this all takes place. God has made these prophecies about Eli and his sons, but it sometimes, you know, it takes place in his timing. So it says, as Samuel grew up, and you have to read like 15, 20 years into that, the Lord was with him, and everything Samuel said proved to be reliable. So as he spoke as a prophet, God speaking to him, his reputation began to grow as the one that God was speaking to, and everything that he said is how it worked out. And all Israel, from Dan to the north to Beersheba in the Bath in the south, knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. So what you have is the beginning of a national identity. And this is important. This lays it out. Samuel is one of the first times, because you go through all the book of Judges, the only time the whole nation of Israel, almost the whole, all of the tribes get together for anything, because the judges were all sort of location, you know, were in specific places, not national with all the tribes. The only time all of them together is when 11 of them get together and attack one, you know, when they fight each other. So now, in this course of the time of Samuel growing up and God speaking to him and beginning to, you know, people beginning to realize that this, hey, we actually have a prophet of God in all of this, you have the beginnings of a national identity. And this is important because this is where Samuel goes. You know, you get to Samuel, to Saul, to David. You know, this is, by the end of his of Samuel's life, this seed of national identity that you have in recognizing him as a prophet begins to have fruition. And so it's important to understand that when they say that, it's not just, you know, we're going to, you know, do this little interlude here. No, there's something important happening. It takes trauma to create a national identity. In our own history, the states and the colonies and the states themselves had individual identities. It took the Revolutionary War to create a national identity. And even some people weren't happy with that. They, you know, the states and states' rights were still supposed to be, you know, for the most part, what determined, you know, the local policies. So it takes a lot, and it took all of Samuel's life to sort of create this national identity of all of Israel recognizing here we have a prophet of God. So understand that, you know, we're sort of getting into that part of it. And it says, and the Lord continued to appear at Shiloh and gave messages to Samuel there at the tabernacle, and Samuel's words went out to all the people of Israel. Now when it says, and the Lord continued to appear at Shiloh while he was at the tabernacle. If you remember, the appearing, the Lord appearing at the tabernacle was the Lord appearing over the mercy seat in the Ark of the Covenant. And it almost goes back to the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day. And in all the time of Judges, that wasn't always there. I mean, these people were not really following God during the time of Judges. I mean, it was like 12, 13 judges and over 400 years, and they just go back and forth, and they're very rebellious and idolatrous, and God's presence wasn't there. So now God is beginning to be present again in his people. Now that they have a national prophet, God is beginning to appear, and that's beginning to happen. And that sort of sets up what takes place when you get to chapter 4. Because this is, you know, because the people are now realizing there's an awareness of God, there's an awareness of their history, their awareness that God is present with them again, and, you know, the prophets and priests are, you know, constantly trying to remind them of their history of what God did in Egypt and all of those kind of things. Although, you know, the people weren't particularly faithfully following God, his presence was being made known again throughout the history. And in this instance, when we get to chapter 4, God gets invited, but God doesn't show up. He's the one that doesn't show up, which is pretty interesting. Maybe sometimes it's the way, you know, you invite people that they don't show up. You know, maybe it's the way they were invited sometimes because they don't appreciate it. You know, there's all kinds of things that's happening. But there's a revival taking place under Samuel. But there gets to be a point in chapter 4, it says in chapter 4, at that time. So Samuel's now basically an adult, probably in his 20s, would be a good guess. And there's another war with the Philistines. And so, you know, the Philistines would come in and raid the land and try to take the crops, and they did that fairly regularly, and it was an ongoing thing. And so the Israelite army was camped near Abenezer, and the Philistines were at Aphek, or however you say that. And they attacked, the Philistines attacked and defeated the army of Israel, killing 4,000 men. So the Philistines attacked, and Israel lost. You know? Well, they had a tendency, you go through Judges, the Israel lost a lot. No, you'll see here. Because what they do is after the battle was over, the troops retreated to their camp, and the elders of Israel asked, why did the Lord allow us to be defeated by the Philistines? And they said, well, let's bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh. If we can carry it into battle with us, it will save us from our enemies. Okay, so let's go get the Ark. Okay, we keep hearing these stories about the Ark and crossing the Red Sea and what God did in Egypt. And okay, let's go get the Ark. The Ark will save us. You hear what they said? The Ark will save us. So the men sent to Shiloh to bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Heaven's armies. You know, they're recognized. Okay. Who is enthroned before the cherubim. Hophni and Phinehas, sons of Eli, were also there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Israelites saw the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord coming into camp, their shout of joy was so loud it made the ground shake. So now they're hopped up on the fact that the Ark is here, and you know, the automatic victory, God is going to intervene, and God is going to do to these guys what he did to the Egyptians, and all the way along. They're relearning their their history, and all of that is that little revival is taking place. They're relearning their history. The ark is there. They cannot lose. What's going on? The Philistines asked. What is all the shouting about in the Hebrew camp? When they were told it was because of the ark of the Lord had arrived, they panicked. The gods have come into their camp, they cried. This is a disaster. We've never had to face anything like this before. Help, who can save us from these mighty gods of Israel? So they didn't understand what's happening, but they had enough of the rumor mill of what had taken place with the Israelites had happened in the past. That, they are the same gods who destroyed the Egyptians with plagues when Israel was in the wilderness. So what they say to their guys is, we've never faced anything like this. Fight as never before, Philistines. If you don't, we will become the Hebrew slaves just as they have been ours. Stand up and like men and fight. So the Hebrews have basically been at their mercy, been their slaves over half the time. He says, stand up and fight now or we're going to be their slaves. So, the Philistines fought desperately and Israel was defeated again. And the slaughter was great. 30,000 Israelite soldiers died that day. The survivors turned and fled to their tent. And the Ark of God was captured. And Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were killed. Now, we've always seen that Hophni and Phinehas were bad guys. They were molesting women in the temple. They were taking bribes. They were taking the meat to the offering. Then we just had no regard for man, no regard for God, no anything. They just inherited a position because it was an inherited position. They disrespected their father, who was the head priest, and they were just bad guys. And the prophecy had been that you guys, your sons are going to be killed on the same day. And so all of this begins to take place. They bring the Ark of the Covenant to the battle. God doesn't show up. Well, yeah, not the way that. Yeah. Well, God didn't show up the way they expected. They expected the Ark of the Covenant to be, the Ark would save them. It was the Ark of God, and they expected the armies of God, and they expected miracles, and they expected victory, and they were basically left alone to die. So, from everything in their experience, God didn't show up. And I'm looking at this thinking, boy, if you want to talk about somebody who, and we talk about this figuratively speaking a lot of times, but you want to talk about a people who sort of kept God in a box? They had, ignored him. They hadn't worshipped him. They hadn't done anything. They just, had him there. They, this identity, this where revival is going. They're relearning their history. And they think, oh, yeah, we'll just bring the ark and it'll do it. And that just having the ark there, we bring the ark and God's going to do his thing. They just sit back, They basically, God had been reduced down to not the national presence, not the presence of, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength, which they were commanded to do. There was none of that. They just knew that Samuel's a prophet, and, God's showing up there at the ark every once in a while in the tabernacle, and God was making his presence known. And what you have to remember is, we have this concept of God is everywhere, God is, God is omnipresent, all of that. They did not. God was present for them in the tabernacle. And because when they came out of Egypt and all of that, we know God exists. There he is. There is his presence in the column of fire and the column of cloud. And they did not have that concept as God. God was not in them as he is in us. So they didn't, all the things that we automatically go to, he's always here, was foreign to them. That's not their experience. That is not the Old Testament experience. For them, God's presence was right then in that place. And when you came to meet God, you went there. So they bring there here, and God didn't come with them. And they ran it. They kept God in the box, and when they ran into trouble, they went and got the box. And all of the things. I mean, you know, they don't have, you know, I mean, granted, it's several hundred years, but you know what God did in Egypt. Even the Philistines knew about what God did in Egypt, and God, you know, them stepping into the Jordan, and the Jordan stopping, and walking with the ark around Jericho. There's so many things that happen that for them it becomes sort of the talisman. It becomes the symbol of God's presence. And so if God was present in their nation, that's where he was. And it just became that. So, you know, they weren't used to being, you know, but after the time of Judges, you would think they'd be used to defeat, but they go get the box, and they think the box is going to do its thing. Again, there's no relationship with God. And that's what sometimes we, you know, I have a hard time with that. Because you think, well, you know, how could they not? They didn't have that relationship with God. Any relationship they had with God was, you know, if they were at their best, you know, the only person who had an intimate relationship with God would be whatever prophet God was speaking to at the time. You know, God wasn't talking to anybody. It was Samuel. You want to hear from God, you go talk to Samuel. Samuel talks to God. Samuel comes back and tells you what God said. There's a whole concept of priesthood. And so they, you know, they're dealing with just their own experiences. And in their own experiences, that's, hey, you know, we carry this box around Jericho seven times and the walls fall down. We carry it into battle and we lose 30,000 guys. You know. And it becomes a real object lesson, because I think sometimes even believers can, you know, look at a calendar, a weekly calendar, so I'm saying a monthly calendar. And on the monthly calendar, each day is a Bible. And Wednesday night is Bible study. So God has two boxes. And it's amazing how many people, those are the boxes God has. He's not in any other box. You know? He's not in those, you know, he's not in the Sunday, Monday through Friday box. They don't go to Wednesday night. He's not in any box except Sunday morning. He's not, he doesn't even get a whole box. It's half a box. And I think a lot of times people go through, you know, and keep God in their little Sunday box. Until Christ has come. And then they want God right now. You know? And sometimes I think, you know, I think when we go back to the sheep and the goats, we were talking about that. You know, what does God say to them? I don't know. You know? That's the most drastic thing in that whole statement. More than get away from me, more than being cast into the fire. And all of the stuff that happens after that is they think they're okay because they've been doing their Sunday box thing. But he wasn't in any other boxes. And he wasn't showing up in how they live. And he, they're assuming relationship. And he's going, I don't know you. Oh. That's the scary part of that. You know, that's the scary part of that. And that's what happened. You know, when you go to, whether it's just going through the rituals of worship on Sunday morning, just go through it on Sunday morning, not really being present and engaged with God, or whether it's just reducing God to Sunday morning and, you know, going through your life and not really thinking about Him or praying or reading His Word except for Sunday morning. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways we can wrap this, but it's what happens. It's why, you know, Friday 9/11 happens and Sunday 9/10 happens and churches are full. October 10th happens, churches are back to normal. The crisis comes, we go into the box. When he should be, like you say, right with us all the time. And we don't need to run to the box. we are the vine, you know, in that sense that he's living within us. If we have that relationship with us, we live in his presence every day. If we don't have that relationship with us, it's a Sunday morning box thing. And so when crisis comes, we run to the box. And a lot of times there's not a whole lot of response. Because before there can be a response in all those promises, there has to be a relationship. If you want to become a Christian and live for Christ, then all these promises apply to you. If you don't, all those New Testament, wonderful New Testament promises do not apply if you're not a believer. All those things about answered prayer and the presence of God and the peace of God, you're not a believer in Christ, they're not yours. These guys did not have that relationship with God. They were beginning to acknowledge God. It makes me think of Isaiah 29, where he says, you know, these people, Jesus quotes it in Matthew, because these people, you know, admire me and praise me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And that's one of those Old Testament things that Jesus quotes. They say all the right things. They do all the right things. But their hearts are not engaged. They're not here. That's pretty scary. God does not bind himself to our forms if we are not bound to his heart and his will. We almost go back, and again, it's tough stuff. It's tough theological nuts to crack in that sense that when we were talking about getting into Eli, Eli was the inheritor of the chief priest position, the high prophet position, and you know, that was supposed to go right through, all the way through till Jesus comes, you know. And yet, God, you know, basically tells Eli, I know this is what I promised, but I will honor those who will honor me if you and your guys are going to die. And you can quote all kinds of scripture, but God says, I will honor those who honor me. If you don't honor him, you're going to go get the box. God ain't going to show up. That's a powerful passage. And that's sort of what happened.
And that's what I mean. It's sort of a hard concept for us, isn't it? God does show up.
But how can he not show up? Well, in their experience, how God was working with them, he didn't. Because he didn't. They weren't bound to him. They weren't. They didn't have their hearts. He was to them, instead of a living God, he was to them an idol. And I think that out. He was to them an idol, a lucky charm. He was to them not a righteous living God that they were to love and to serve and to worship. He was an idol. He was the prayer book you bring out, you know, when everything start getting tough. Things that give you comfort. That's not what he was. And that, it's, you know, and what it leads to is their defeat. And God begins to bring to fruition what he said. Because when Samuel was a little guy, God told him right when he was 5, 6, 7 years old, when he began to talk to him, I am about to do a shocking thing in Israel. But it was 20 years later. See, God doesn't measure time like we do. You know, that's why it's, you know, you got to remember that. I always love that verse because it says, I'm about to do something really shocking in Israel, but it doesn't happen for 20 years. God doesn't see time the way we see time. You know, God sees, you know, the years, a thousand days, and a thousand days like a day is like a thousand years, and then, yeah, that's right. Day is like a thousand years, and years like a thousand, whatever. But you get the idea. I can't. It's going to be that way this morning. But, you know, you have a hard time. That's how God doesn't see time the way we do. He's going to do a shocking thing. What's the shocking thing? What is the shocking thing? You go get the ark, I don't show up. And you lose. I don't have your heart. You lose. There's a shocking message. That's a shocking message. If I don't have your heart, you're going to lose. So you get to the next passage, and the word begins to come back. Eli's sort of sitting there. He's 89 years old or 98 years old at this point. He's 98 years old, and he's still the head guy. Samuel's now 20 or 25 and being the prophet, but Eli's still that head priest, and he knows they took the Ark of the Covenant. And he knows they probably shouldn't have taken the Ark of the Covenant, but he never did have any control of his sons, and that was going to bring condemnation on all of them. And so he's freaking out. And when messengers come back and say, "Do you have any news?" He answers, keep thinking of Robin Hood men in tights, Do you have news? Yes, frankly, it's bad. Can you tell it to me in a good way? it's bad news, We lost. Your sons were killed. The Philistines captured the ark. And Eli goes, falls off the platform, breaks his neck, and dies. So he and his sons died on the same day. And he's in a panic. And one of his daughter-in-laws, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant. And this news throws her into labor, and she gives birth to the baby and dies. But she calls the baby Ichabod. That makes you think of Ichabod. Yeah, the headless horseman, Ichabod Crane. Ichabod, which means, where's the glory? Yeah. Where's the glory? The glory of Israel is gone. Now, she's absolutely right and absolutely wrong. Well, she's looking, she's looking at it from the, she's seeing this picture of, the chief priest, his sons, her husband, all killed, 30,000 Israelites killed, the Philistines capturing them again, taking over, they take the Ark of the Covenant. Where is the glory of Israel? Where is the glory of God in any of this? Where is the glory? And even big picture wise, she's like, call him Ichabod, where's the glory? It's gone. And she's absolutely right. It is gone, but it isn't. Because what God has done has basically changed hands. Because he's switching from the family of Eli, which should have been the inherited priest position, to Samuel. Samuel's already the prophet, the one that God is speaking to in the nation of Israel. And from here on out, it's all going to be about Samuel. And from here on out, the nation becomes identified, they get their first king, he screws up, they get the best king they ever had, and David. All of this happens in Samuel's lifetime. By the time Samuel's an old man, in this guy's life, the glory of Israel begins to really shine. But it rings sort of true. You know that old saying, it's always darkest before the dawn? And if you're in that dark spot, and you think the sun is never going to come, That's where she was. So she calls him Ichabod. Aren't you glad we don't name our kids like that anymore? Ichabod. There's some crazy names out there. So God is at work. God is on the verge of creating this magnificent country that would be made of His people, that would be part of a prophecy that would be, that would have His blessing until they turned away from Him. And then He would use them, even though they really don't turn to Him again. They would bring them back together as they are now. Israel's not a Christian nation. And Israel isn't particularly even a Jewish nation. And God is with them because of the promises, not because they honor Him. They don't. But they're part of this whole prophetic thing, and eventually, hopefully, many of them will come to Him. If you follow the prophecy, a lot of them will. So the promise of that salvation is there for them. But, God's working a bigger picture. He's working a bigger plan. sometimes, you know, I mean, that's what we need to do, isn't it? We need to make sure we see a bigger picture, you know, a bigger plan. You know, we got to make sure we put God back in our life. You know, I mean, it gets now. We do get some fun things that happen because the Philistines have captured the Ark of God, the thing they associate with the defeat of the Israelites, the thing they associate with Israel's defeat of everybody when they took over the land, the thing that, you know, stops the water of the rivers and knocks the city walls down. This is, they captured it. So they take it back to their main city and take it into the temple next to their main god, Dagon. And they sit it at the foot of Dagon. Okay, my Dagon, you know, right here is Dagon. They set the box right next to it because, okay, no, Dagon is superior over that. They get up the next morning and Dagon's fallen over. They put him back up. They get up the next morning and Dagon's fallen over. And no head. You know, I mean, just every time they do it, you know, you just read through that. It's sort of, it, you know, it's sort of funny. And it goes through it. You know, they came back and he'd fallen on his face, and the Lord again, his head and hands were broken off, and, you know, lying in the doorway. So the head and hands are broken off, and not only broken off, but lying in the doorway where you can't come in. You know, only the trunk of his body. And then in verse 6, it says, then the Lord's heavy hand struck the people of Ashdod and nearby villages with a plague of tumors. Greek and Vulgate read tumors. Now, I got to tell you, when you get into the Hebrew here, the Hebrew is a very unique language. And while this gets translated tumors, literally it is boils in the dark places.
He gave them hemorrhoids. Big, bad, ugly ones. The whole populace woke up one day in the days before Preparation H with hemorrhoids. And they cried out, we can't keep this thing here. He is against us. We'll all be destroyed. You gotta
love God's sense of humor. I mean, just, you know, that's what it says. You know, so it's just a kick. So they called together all the Philistine towns, and what should we do with the Ark of the Covenant? None of them want the town, this thing in their town now. So let's move it to the town of Gath. They moved it to Gath, and when they moved it to Gath, the Lord's heavy hand fell upon its men, young and old. They struck them with a plague of tumors. And you know, same thing. You know, get there and the same thing happens. And now everybody's in a panic. And when they sent it to Ekron, everybody there cried out, you know. And they said, send it back to the people of Israel, you know, for the deadly plague of God has already begun, and great fear is sweeping across the town, and those who didn't die were afflicted with tumors, and the cry, I mean, it's just like they tried, every Philistine town tried to pass it on to the next town, and the panic got worse and worse and worse. And even though, and here's sort of here's the contrast. In Israel, you have Phinehas' wife giving birth to Ichabod, naming him Ichabod, going, where's the glory? Where's the glory of Israel is gone? We're just in this dark place where hope and glory is gone. You can't even depend on God and the Ark of the Covenant for the battles, and everybody's dead, and it's dark. It's a dark and terrible and desperate place. But the Philistine town, they're all going, man, that God is something else. That God is really powerful. Let's get him, let's get this away from us because we don't want anything. And God's glory is showing up over here in some very unique ways. And while here the very people of God are in this dark spot, saying there is no glory, God is working his glory somewhere else. And that's all we
always a thing to remember. That what sometimes we're in the dark spot. And we can't see the forest for the trees. But God is still there. God is still there. It's sort of like a Psalm 34, you know, King David. I will praise the Lord at all times. His praise will be on my lips. Come, let us rejoice in the Lord together. And let's praise his name. You know, I this poor man called and the Lord saved him. I was desperate and the Lord heard my prayer. But come, let's praise the Lord. Because the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him. David wrote those words when he had to flee from his son, Absalom's rebellion. Had to go to a foreign king and act like he was crazy in order not to be killed. They think he's so crazy, they kick his sorry backside out, and now he's alone in the wilderness, hiding for his life. And at that deep, dark spot, he says, let's praise the Lord at all times. His praise is always on my lips. May the name of the Lord encamps around those who fear him. An encampment is a military term for an army encamped on the field. He said, even in the darkest, darkest moment, God is there. We may not be able to perceive it because of our circumstances. But when we are his, that's his power. That's powerful. That's powerful. And it shows you how far they went from where they were here to where they are where David is. But David was a man after God's own heart. David really hit the same dark spot he was in. Two people in the same dark spot, in desperate straits, death and defeat all around them. One is going, where's the glory? The other is going, the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him. One recognizes God, and one says, where is God? One had God's heart. I guess the point of the story is we have to keep God in the heart. God in the heart. And this is him. Sometimes we have a tendency to write off Old Testament stuff and say, well, God was different in the Old Testament. He operated a different way. No, not really. Granted, it was a different covenant. And it was a legal covenant with a specific group of people, you know, but the expectations were no different. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. The expectations were no different. And if you didn't love God and honor him, or didn't care for each other, you could go through all the rituals and do all the things and obey the law, end up where the Pharisees were. Do everything right and still be wrong. You can do everything right and still be wrong. God's going to be in the heart, in the box. So, when we get back next week, they send the ark back. In pre-FedEx and UPS days. And they send the ark back. And that doesn't even go smoothly. But we'll see how that goes next week. I guess we better pray. Father, thank you. It's so fascinating to go through these Old Testament stories, to look at the story of this, and so grateful you told this in story form, because it captures the imagination when we see how the story unfolds, and we see these places that Israel finds themselves in, the darkest places in their history, and how some react one way and some react another. Bless us today to your love and grace. Maybe serve you. Gather your church together, Father. I know, a lot of people are gone, Lord, and you know where everybody is, and you're going to bring them home safe. So gather everybody here today for worship.